Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Movie buff specialist Phil and John are back. I don't think I said Phil and John last time, but we're back with the 97th ranked movie on our list. Don't worry if you're just joining. It's only our fourth episode. Don't get worried. But John and I are counting down our top 100 movies of all time, our favorite 100 movies of all time, before you go thinking that necessarily some of these movies we're saying are better than other classics that might drive your cinephile brain absolutely insane. So we have gone through three movies together already. Some of the episodes have been pretty similar. Tropic Thunder and The Dark Knight was one of those, very similar movies there in terms of comedies, action, pretty big name actors in both. We also had one where it was Toy Story and The Wrestler, two very opposite movies. And if you're joining today for number 97, you are definitely in for something that has nothing to do with each other. And that is A Knight's Tale from 2001 and the NC-17 here in America rated Shame from 2011. This was the first time I had seen A Knight's Tale, and it was the first time John had seen Shame. So while it ends up on both of our lists, it is a first viewing. John, welcome back. Hope you had a good week. How you feeling about going into A Knight's Tale and Shame, two movies that pretty much should be a double feature for everybody every week?
Well, it's a great double feature because after you watch Shame, you can lighten things up with The Knight's Tale afterwards. But I'm doing great. A Knight's Tale is just such a classic to me, just because of, like, when I first saw it, when it first came out, and how often I've seen it since it was released. And Shame is such a beautiful movie. I was really excited to watch both of these this week.
Yeah, this is the first time I watched A Knight's Tale. It had always been around. I feel like it had always been on a list and people always talked about it, but it was such a divisive movie. People either loved it or they hated it. Like, there was nobody who was like, that's a 2-star movie and we'll move on. It was like, that's a 0-star butchering of Chaucer, or it's a classic that everybody should watch right now. So like Jordan Alford just said, as much as A Knight's Tale is on TV, have you never seen it before? I just watched it on TNT because I didn't want to pay for it. And I feel like watching it, like, it was on like the TNT app, which has commercials every like 20 minutes or something. And I was like, this kind of feels like how this movie should be watched. And that's not a knock on the movie. We'll talk about it in a little bit. I actually quite enjoyed it, but Shame is one of those movies. The first time I ever saw this movie, me and my friends, we had to drive an hour and 20 minutes to go see it because it wasn't playing in my town, because if it was, it would have made 50 cents for the theater. So we drove to Voorhees, New Jersey to see it. And in this theater, wasn't very crowded, but these two old people were sitting right in front of us. I'm telling you, they had to be in their 70s, and they were sitting right in front of us. And in the orgy scene at the end of the movie, the lady turns to her husband and says, I think he's having sex with them because he's sad. And I don't think I've ever laughed harder in a movie in my entire life, but it was one of those things where, like, me and my friends will still say that to each other all the time. But these movies could not be any further apart from each other. And neither movie, it could be trying to do different things from one another. So we're going to start it off with A Knight's Tale tonight, because I do not want to make anybody who is sensitive to gratuitous nudity and, you know, violent moments have to sit through Shame. So we'll start with A Knight's Tale so that you can dip out if you feel so inclined. Normally we will do the bigger movie at the end, but in this case it makes sense because it is NC-17. And as John said, it's because we're American. He said it's rated R in Canada and we should just grow up and get used to it. But starting with A Knight's Tale, John, it's your movie. This was my first watch. I'm assuming you've seen it millions of times. How you feeling about your placement of your number 97 movie?
I love A Knight's Tale. And it's definitely, you look at my list, it's definitely like the least technical of the films that I have on the list. It's easily the most successful of the films on my list. And all that just comes back. I saw this movie in theaters back in 2001. And I've seen it at least once every year since then. So it's one that comes up a lot of the time. And yeah, as a kid growing up, it would be, oh, A Knight's Tale's on TV. Let's tune in and watch. And as we've grown out of, you know, cable and into streaming service and stuff like that, there'll just be a night where I'm like looking for something to watch. It's like, yeah, I'll watch A Knight's Tale. And it's just a fun movie. As I've grown older, I grow up to appreciate it more because I understand it a lot more. Mm-hmm. I understand what it's trying to do. I understand that it's rooted in English literature, well, not quite rooted in English literature. Mm-hmm. And it's just a fun movie. It's a fun movie to get you going on a night where you just need a movie that doesn't make you think about all these deep, dark aspects of life.
What I liked about this movie, it is pure escapism. And I think that that's sometimes what people are really looking for in a movie. Now, I was shocked. This movie only has a 59% Rotten Tomatoes. While this would never end up anywhere near my top 100 because I don't have the same type of personal connection as John does with it and as other people who probably love this movie do, to me, this still felt like it should have been in the 70s. You know, it's not one of those movies that's like a perfect movie where you're like, oh boy, those critics who write for The New Yorker are just going to love this one. But I would think from an entertainment standpoint, it really, to me, nails a lot of that. And to me, this is, to me, what Armageddon is. Because Armageddon is a movie I saw when it first came out in theaters. I guess that was 97, 98, 99, whatever it was. I think it was 99. 98? Somebody tell me. But when I saw that movie for the first time, I saw it in theaters. And over quarantine during COVID and all of that, I was staying with my fiance and her parents. And I would... It was literally on like twice a day. And my fiance and her mom would get so mad at me because I'd be sitting there just like watching Armageddon. And they're like, what are you doing? And I'm like, it's Armageddon. Why would I not have this on? And I just think, like you said, like there's nights where you're just like, you know what? I don't want to overthink. I want that kind of just popcorn movie where it's totally, totally entertaining. So you sit down and you watch it. And A Knight's Tale is that. That being said, I'm going to butcher his last name because it's somebody I haven't thought of since, what was that, Firewall? Paul Bettany, Bettany, whatever, however Bettany, you want to say. Bettany? Is it Bettany?
I think so.
His performance in this movie is actually really, 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 really good. Like, to the point of there's always that one random Oscar nominee that'll happen where, like, the movie's not nominated for a single other thing. And then you're like, oh, but that guy was pretty good, so we should probably give him a nomination. Like, if he would have gotten nominated in 2001, which I think is one of the best years for movies in the history of film, I would not have been disappointed because he just sells it. He just buys 100% into it. And being that it's a popcorn movie, obviously he'll never get credit in that way. But I was watching it, I'm like, this guy's going like hard in this. Like, he is going all in for this performance. I think it works. I think he absolutely nails it. And he adds a nice element to the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And just him personifying Geoffrey Chaucer in this way, where it's our only historical figure really in this, essentially what's a sports movie.
Yeah.
And you just see that it's so much based on Chaucer because we have all these characters popping up from the Canterbury Tales throughout the entire movie. And the way Paul Bettany comes into this movie, the first time we see him, he's butt naked.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just oozes his panache throughout the entire movie. He's overselling everything, but you know he's doing that because he's a writer, and it's what writers do. They over-exaggerate everything.
Yeah, and he does it perfectly. And I don't know, for like a movie that's as just like kind of campy as this one is, where it's just like you sit down and you're just like, yeah, this is great. Like, let me just sit down and watch this, love every second. Like, he does kind of bring, he elevates it, like, to a different point. And I love this depiction of Chaucer. And, you know, this is a bad word for a lot of people who are going to be listening to this, but I have Shakespeare in Love on my list. And a lot of people are probably like, F you, man, get the hell out of here. But I love the depiction that Joseph Fiennes gives of Shakespeare in that, because it is the over-the-top struggling artist. It's total BS. And people like the Shakespeare historians, my fiance is was a medieval Renaissance major in college. And so it's like, oh, but that movie's not. Well, no, duh, it's not accurate. It's a movie. Like, that's what it is. And it's an over exaggeration of the struggle that writers go through, written by a writer who knows that this isn't actually what these writers went through, or at least not to the extent that it's being portrayed. I doubt Geoffrey Chaucer was walking around naked because of his gambling addiction and still also had time to write the Canterbury Tales. So, like, I think it's just a really interesting concept, a really interesting character. And I love the way that it ends up playing out in this movie. So good for Paul Bettany for doing what he did in this movie and elevating it with a cast that's actually very, very, very loaded.
Yeah, a very loaded cast of a bunch of unknowns at the time, too.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's 2001. Heath Ledger hasn't really broken in too much at this point. He's done, what, 10 Things I Hate About You at this point, and that's about it.
10 Things I Hate About You might have actually come after. I got to look
it's
this
up. It's very possible. But so Heath Ledger's new on the scene. It's before Brokeback Mountain. Alan Tudyk hasn't even done Firefly yet. Mm-mm. And
Mark Addy hasn't done anything. James Purefoy, who plays King Richard in this, goes on to be iconic in Rome. One of the great performances of all time is Mark Antony. He's unbelievable in that series, a miniseries from HBO. If nobody's seen it, you should definitely watch that. Unbelievable. Mark Addy, who ends up being, what do you call it? Robert Baratheon in Game of Thrones. Shannon Sossaman, who I had the biggest crush on of all time when she was in Wrist Cutters. Oh my God, Wrist Cutters. She is so amazing in that movie. I loved her. Granted, I watched that movie when I was like 18 years old, so I don't know if she was actually good in it or if I just thought she was super hot and I wanted to be a guy from Almost Famous who is dead and pretty much dating her. And then also a great hidden character in this, Berenice Bejo, who ends up going on to be nominated for The Artist and arguably should have won. I know her performance wasn't as big as Octavia Spencer's, who could have probably been lead, but what do I know? But she's in this movie and she has like 15 speaking lines. Like, it's crazy how many people were loaded into this movie.
Yeah, exactly. And you can tell they're all just kind of having fun with it too, because it is like I said, this is a sports movie. This is a movie about jousting, just like we have Rudy about football. This is the exact same type of movie. And it's just because of the era it takes place in, a lot of people don't realize that about this movie. Mm-hmm. But they really lean into it with our 70s rock soundtrack to this movie, which is a killer soundtrack. And again, that kind of pulls on that childhood memory for me, because this is the music my dad's pumping in the car all the time and at home. So that really evokes that childhood memory for me as well. And the choice to have it seem in that first scene when We Will Rock You's playing, it kind of seems at first that it's incidental music, and then you're like, wait, this is diegetic music? And like, it's exactly at that point you know what you're in for with this movie.
And I think that part of the reason why, you know, the acclaim wasn't there for this movie is making a period piece and not owning the period is going to bother people, because at the end of the day, a lot of people who are critics and whatever, they have backgrounds in something like this. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of times, I mean, if you look at a movie critic, very rarely are they a business student who was like, well, now I'm going to go be a film critic. A lot of times they do have these random kind of things, and then they just found their way in and they were able to make it work. And when you take something and don't do it literally like this, it's almost like their chance to like snob you to death. You know what I mean? And I feel like that was one of those. I remember when this movie came out, because it came out the same year as Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring, which obviously isn't going to help the fact that they come out the same time. So you're going to be compared to that from a medieval standpoint. But it's interesting that the biggest conversation was, well, they played that music in it. And it's like, okay, it's like when Tarantino made Inglourious Basterds and he has cat people playing and people are like, well, that movie, that song didn't come out yet. That's a mistake. It's like, if you think that's a mistake, you literally don't understand like anything, because it's not a mistake if it's done purposefully and it's a stylistic choice. Yes, the song hadn't been written yet. If you think Quentin Tarantino didn't know that, then like, you need to research Quentin Tarantino. And I feel like that was the same thing here, where people are like, well, how could they do this? They're all clapping and stomping their feet to We Will Rock. It's like, but it's essentially just, it's making a joke of like, this is what America and this is what the world is now. Just everything's a giant sporting event. And what if back in the day they got as amped to watch people like kill each other half the time?
Yeah, exactly. And I actually have a really funny story about this, because when I was teaching, we did a little unit on Chaucer and the Canterbury Tales, and we showed a Knight's Tale, because really a Knight's Tale couldn't exist if Chaucer actually finished the Canterbury Tales as he intended, because we never got that second Knight's Tale. We could kind of have this as like a, oh, maybe this is kind of where Chaucer was going with it. But I'm showing it to my class, and one of my students asks, how do they know that song back then? And it's like, well, you see, that's not how this works. And it was just one of those fun learning moments where it's like, yeah, this is a song from the 70s, and they're playing it in the 11th century. But it's a ton of fun, because we do know that. And it brings us into it, because it is that sports movie. And I think there's only one moment in this entire movie where the modern, where that 70s soundtrack inspired sound doesn't work. And that is the first time William sees Jocelyn. No song plays. It's just an instrumental, but it has the guitar, the electric guitar, and it's so out of place considering everything else. And that's the one moment where I think the music doesn't work in this movie.
Yeah, and I get that. You know, like, there's always going to be those things. What's funny to me, though, is so this was written and directed by Brian Helgeland, and he had written L.A. Confidential, which I think is one of the great screenplays ever written. That'll be on my list. That'll be in a little bit. I love that movie. I think it's an incredible screenplay. Co-wrote that with Curtis Hanson. I didn't realize that he had written and directed A Knight's Tale, and he's a hit or miss kind of guy. Man on Fire, people either love it or hate it, very much the same way with A Knight's Tale. And that was another one he did. But it's almost like nobody respected him as an artist to make these artistic decisions, where then you go back and watch like Godard, and in Weekend, there's people who literally can't be existing at the same time. And everybody's like, oh, Godard, look at him go. I mean, what a guy, huh? And it's like, okay, so if you're considered an artist by the highbrow establishment, then that means you can get away with these things. But if you're not, well, then you don't actually know what you're doing. It's like, I mean, well, like I said, this is like a 3-star movie to me. This isn't something that I'm just sitting here going, oh, rave review. But it's still, I don't get those types of criticisms, because I get what you're saying, where sometimes it just doesn't work. But the people who just want to point at it and say, like, this was a bad movie because they played this music and it didn't exist, it's like, well, so what? Like, I don't get that.
Yeah, exactly. For that one moment that it doesn't work, we have David Bowie working perfectly, right?
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter as much. Yeah, it's not high art like some of these other films. And that's what people kind of critique this movie about, because it was coming out at a time where people were really focused on actually setting period pieces in a period. And it kind of broke that mold in 2001. But I think that's what makes this movie so accessible at the same time.
Absolutely. And I say that this is like a perfect Saturday movie. Like, this is a movie, if you're looking for something that just puts you in a good mood, this is the movie to watch. Don't overthink it. Don't think too hard about it. Like, you don't have to sit down and nitpick this. You know, like, if you nitpick it, you're going to find flaws. You're going to find things that you don't like about it. But don't sit down and nitpick it, and just sit down and watch it. And I think too, like, yes, if we were doing top 100 movies of all time, John, I don't think that you would have this movie on your list. Like, if you were saying, what are the 100 best made movies of all time? A Knight's Tale is not going to come in on your list. But when you're talking favorite, it's a different approach. And so I think for people, like, you have to know what you're going into a movie to watch. If I went into Shame expecting Shame and I got A Knight's Tale, I'd be like, ew, that was not intentional. And what was it? It's the line between like art and crap is intention or something like that. Yeah. Like, the intention of this is to just be popcorn. People like to rip on Michael Bay. At the end of the day, you can't really name a bad Michael Bay movie aside from Pearl Harbor, because they're normally entertaining. Even though you're not going to be like, give him an Oscar, you're still sitting there going, okay, like, I'm kind of into this. Like, I'm entertained by the stupidity of these people are going to go drill on an asteroid so that it saves the Earth. Like, literally can't happen, but sure, why not? Let's pretend it can. That's entertaining. And, you know, Jordan Alford says that's why it's always on TV. I do agree. I think that, you know, this isn't one of those 1.5-star movies where it just totally misses and nobody wants to pick it up. this movie's always on TNT, TBS, those types of channels, because people really, really, really want to watch these movies. And Gamer Girl, I haven't seen the Transformers, so that actually should probably be prefaced. But people want to watch this movie at any point of their day. And I think that there's something to be said for that.
Yeah, exactly. Because as much as we're talking about these more artistic movies throughout this list, the one thing it comes down to when it comes to movies is they're supposed to elicit some sort of emotion. And despite what our list might say, sometimes it's okay for that emotion just to be happiness.
Yeah. Yeah. Which we'll talk about in about 10 minutes, pure happiness. But another person who's in this that we didn't talk about is Rufus Sewell. Rufus Sewell. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to say his last name, but again, I don't know how to say any of these last names. So I'm really showing my flaws here. I did look up Helgoland though, because I looked up his LA Confidential win. But so he's in this movie. He goes on to be relatively successful. He's in one of my movies that just missed my top 100, which is The Illusionist. I think that's an absolute classic. I think that's a super underrated movie where he plays the Crown Prince. I love him in that. Jessica Biel, Ed Norton, Paul Giamatti, super underrated movie that came out at the same year as The Prestige. And I think blows The Prestige away, but all the credit went to Christopher Nolan because that tends to be what happens. But I love that he is your Snidely Whiplash villain in this. Mm-hmm. Where like every line of dialogue is so over the top. Like when he's talking to Shannon Sossaman, who I can't remember her name in the movie, but when he's talking to her and it's like, you know, he's pretty much twirling his mustache, like, ha, look at this fool. Ha ha, what an idiot. Like, but it's fun. It's fun. And that's all it's trying to be. It's trying to make you feel like you said, it's a Rudy set in the Middle Age or is set in medieval times. That's all it is. And, you know, I think really the characters, I love watching Mark Addy run after the horse every time and go, like every single time. It's like watching a boxing movie montage. Every single time he's doing the same thing. I think the actors really lean into what they were doing. And, you know, as you said, a lot of these people were relatively unknown at the time. This made a lot of careers, and Rufus Sewell was one of them, for sure. It really turned him into – he got a little typecast, but it definitely opened up his career.
Yeah, I mean, I have Rufus Sewell in another movie we're going to discuss in a few weeks that happened – that was made before this, but because I have Dark City on my list.
So we'll that's a great Sewell movie. Yeah.
A little later.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's – it's he's so fun in this movie, and he is that he feels like a Shakespearean villain in this movie. And that's kind of the nice thing about this movie is, are there really many people who are wondering why all of Europe can all of a sudden speak English while you're watching this movie?
The best.
No. You buy into this suspension of disbelief that every single person here can have an English accent except for the Frenchmen.
Who are so over the top French.
Yeah. It's a Monty Python-esque take on a French accent, right? And it doesn't matter because that's the disbelief we have. And we get that Shakespearean feel from Adhemar in this movie. And we get kind of that like goofy Shakespearean character in Chaucer in the movie. And it's just playing on these tropes in literature. And part of that comes from the fact that it's inspired by Chaucer. Part of that comes from the fact that it's a very English-heavy movie.
Yeah.
But it's so fun because of it, because you know what to expect from these characters.
Yeah, and I think that's a reason why when people remake Shakespeare movies, they tend to do pretty well. They're not normally super expensive movies, and they tend to find their audience most of the time. Why does every freaking Jane Austen book get made into 75 different movies? Because people are into them. It's like a comfort food that people really like. And so I think with this, you know, it's when you look at those classics, yes, Chaucer isn't as well known as either of those people, but it is one of those things where you can see a lot of the same thing in these characters and you know what you're going to get. The reason people sit down and watch Emma, which I guess just came out, I don't even know if that was a Jane Austen novel, but the reason people sit down and watch that, or Love and Friendship, the Whit Stillman movie with Kate Beckinsale, is because it's a different spin on something you're familiar with. And I think A Knight's Tale was just trying to do that. It didn't call itself Hamlet, or it didn't call itself, you know, Romeo and Juliet, but it still had a lot of the same characters and same storylines as those classic plays. And absolutely, I mean, I mean, not that I'm a Shakespearean at all, but the whole point of the Chaucer character is to be that the comedic relief in a movie that, even though it's not a dark movie, it has its moments of like seriousness where like Heath Ledger's character is trying to get through everything and do what he can. And it's like, okay, he's trying to do that. But now we have Chaucer and Mark Addy and Alan Tudyk, who we can kind of rely on for the comic relief as things start to get serious in this movie.
Yeah, and there are just a ton of great one-liners in this movie to help relieve those tension, mm-hmm. or those situations that are more tense too, right? Like, we had that argument between Jocelyn and William about going to the ball and him saying, why are you always talking about putting clothes on? And Paul Bettany leans over and says, I think she's talking about taking them off. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's just those little moments that just add to this movie because it makes it feel more real.
Yeah.
Despite how far off it is from us, despite how fantastical it is, it just feels like these characters are real, despite the fact that they're so far removed from time.
Yeah, and I think it comes down to the buddy aspect of it, where really, like, this is the type of movie where, like, when you and your friends are drinking, sitting around talking about, man, if we were born in the medieval times, or if we were born in the Middle Ages, or we weren't, like, this is what it would have been. Like, this is how you imagine it. Mm-hmm. Like, a squire's life wasn't nearly as good as these guys' lives were. A knight was not, like, Heath Ledger's not going to be able to just pick up and become, you know, von Lichtenstein. Like, that's just not going to happen. But that suspension of disbelief and the fact that it's just, like, it is ultimately a buddy comedy, you know, it's, how can I do this to impress the girl the entire time? That's the movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the movie. And it's a buddy comedy. And I think, you know, that's what does make it feel a little bit more realistic. And I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, I don't know anybody who doesn't like this movie. I just know the reviews on it were always like, and you know, sometimes people just aren't willing to watch something with that lens at the same time as it's coming out. You know, I was actually, really weird side note, and don't worry, John, I'm not insulting A Knight's Tale like this, but recently watched The Haunted Mansion, the Eddie Murphy movie. Mm-hmm. Not a very good movie, but also not nearly as bad as it was received. Why was it so poorly received? Because Eddie Murphy had made a huge pile of crap for years leading up to that movie. Yes, Shrek was in there, but all his live action stuff was bad. And critics and people were tired of watching and paying money, and actors and stuff were getting mad. Like, why does this guy get to keep making bad movies and make money? So people were angry with him. That movie came out today. It's not a 14 or 13 or whatever it is on Rotten Tomatoes. It's higher than that. And I think that this is the same type of movie where, like, yeah, it might not have the political statements of some of the movies that are coming out now in 2021, or, you know, Judas and the Black Messiah that just released this week. Okay. Yeah. It might not have quite that level of what it's trying to do, but it's not trying to do that. And I think people just weren't willing when it comes out at the same time as, like you said, it's coming out in an era where a lot of these movies were coming out and it was take it seriously. Lord of the Rings. Like, how can we get every little detail in this movie to be as impactful as possible? It just was not the right time for it. But ultimately, it leads to a lot of people who ended up being in the right place at the right time as their careers just started to explode after this.
Yeah, absolutely. And even if this movie was released today, it does kind of still have some political undertones if you're paying attention to it, because it's really about class mobility, yeah. Right? And it's just such an optimistic take on class mobility that we even get to the point where, spoiler alert, at the end of the movie...
Didn't mention spoilers.
But there are spoilers. At the end of the movie where the Black Prince just comes and is like, oh yeah, William totally is descended from an ancient line of royalty, I swear. And like, that's fun. It's like, it's so tongue-in-cheek that if you're not really paying attention, you're like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. And then you're like, no, that makes no sense whatsoever. Mm-hmm. I see what you're doing here. And it's fun.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think, you know, you have your people who are coming from the rich thing and all of that. And how do you get the respect of the rich as you do what the rich aren't used to? You know, like when he actually goes against King Richard, even though everybody else is waving the white flag and surrendering, like those little moments. I mean, that, you know, it is about class mobility and stuff. I think you'd have different actors playing different roles. That's for sure. If this was made in 2021. I don't think Heath Ledger would be your lead in this. That's for sure. But, you know, I do think, I mean, Heath Ledger was an incredibly charismatic guy. And I will say that had he lived longer, I think his career path would have taken on a similar route to Matthew McConaughey, where I think people didn't take him seriously and they were starting to take him seriously. Brokeback Mountain obviously gives a phenomenal performance. Dark Knight, he wins the Oscar for. And I think he was starting to hit that level, like what we saw happen with McConaughey once finally it was like, all right, I'm going to go True Detective, Dallas Buyers Club in the same year and almost get three quarters of an EGOT at the same time. Yeah. Like that was, it was like, you know, he was right there on the cusp. I guess he would have gotten half of an EGOT. Sorry. But I think that if Ledger would have if he would have lived longer, he would have definitely had the potential to continue to grow and expand his audience. Maybe like Robert Pattinson, you know, Robert Pattinson was really not taken seriously. And then once he started to prove he could really act, I mean, he's getting some roles now and he deserves them because he's really incredibly talented.
Yeah, no, 100% agree. And I mean, Heath Ledger was kind of doing it before McConaughey too, right? Mm-hmm. So it is a shame that we didn't get more out of him, but
yeah.
In the end, his body of work is still so entertaining.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And somebody who definitely didn't get the respect he deserved in life and is now getting so much of it, you know, posthumously. So you said it's a shame. Should we continue? Do you have anything else you want to say about A Knight's Tale or anything else?
No, I think it's time we move on to Shame.
All right. So it's a shame, says John. All right, so as I said, when I saw Shame, I saw this in Voorhees. This came out. Me and my friends thought we were really cool going to see it because, like, ooh, like boobs and butts and what, you know, it was NC-17. We had gone the year before, we had gone to New York to see Blue Valentine, which is the most undeservedly rated NC-17 movie of all time. Literally no business. The Weinstein, obviously Harvey Weinstein's a terrible, terrible person, but maybe the only time in his life he was ever right was trying to get Blue Valentine lowered from an NC-17 to an R. Because there's no reason that movie should be NC-17, and I'm sure John will get into that deeply. Shame, I understand a little bit more. So Shame is one of those movies, like when it came out, everybody was talking about like, yo, this is a brutal movie, and it is gratuitous, but it is such a realistic depiction. And what I always find fascinating about this movie that I don't think is talked about enough, because ultimately Shame isn't that seen because it's an NC-17 movie, because people kind of avoid it when they can. It doesn't get any Oscar nominations, zero Oscar nominations for Steve McQueen's Shame. But yeah, I know, we'll get there. But I think what it says is the world's willingness to talk about addiction, whether it's drug addiction. How many movies are made about heroin addicts or cocaine addicts or something like that? Alcohol addiction? The Lost Weekend wins Best Picture back in 43, I think something like that. In there, 40 maybe. But it wins Best Picture all the way back then. And nowadays you're seeing Leaving Las Vegas, Nicolas Cage's best performance of all time. Alcohol addiction. But when it comes to sex addiction, it's like, no, 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 we don't go there. And what's fascinating to me is this movie is made in 2011. At the height of when internet porn started to become a bigger thing, because up until that point, and I know I'm on the Survivor Specialist podcast, but guys, this is all important. We're going at this point, you're going from dial up to now all of a sudden everybody's just got the world at their fingertips. You can stream YouTube videos. You can do this, and porn started to kind of take off with that. And this movie is about what happens when you go too far with these things and you literally can't escape. And I think it's so amazing that movies like this don't get made. Movies about sex addicts don't get made. And yet you have alcohol and drug and any other type of addiction getting made every year and people winning Oscars for them. And this, it's like, no, it's an untouched taboo subject. And I guess it's just because we're American. But to me, this is one of the most beautiful films ever made. I love Steve McQueen. I wish he would make more movies. I think every single thing he's done is a masterpiece. But I do think that this is his mask. Like, this is the one that is just heads above the rest. And that's not to say his other movies are phenomenal, but this is the one to me that is just in a class of its own.
Yeah, this movie blew me away. I wasn't sure what to expect with the way you'd been building up to it. And I watched it, I'm like, this isn't that gratuitous. What are you talking about? Then I realized it is definitely the American aspect of it, where Americans just don't want to talk about sex for some reason. Mm-hmm. And even in Canada, we're much more open with sex. This movie's only rated 18A here, which is essentially the equivalent of an American R movie. In fact, Phil and I were talking earlier this week trying to figure out what a Canadian R-rated movie is, which is our NC-17. And it takes a lot. It takes Gaspar Noé, apparently. But
yeah,
that's about it.
Yeah, which makes sense because he deserves it. But go ahead.
But I'm watching it. Every aspect of this movie is so beautiful. I was so engrossed in this film the moment it started. I love every shot, every single moment of it. The entire structure of the film is so beautiful. And this movie makes you just feel this titular emotion the entire time. Mm-hmm. You're feeling the shame of Michael Fassbender's character. You're feeling the shame of Carey Mulligan's character. You're feeling shame in yourself for watching this movie. But it's so good.
Yeah. I mean, you're even feeling shame in James Badge Dale's character. And I think he's another underrated actor who really doesn't get much work anymore. But there was a period of time there. He was in Flight. He had a very small role. He's in Shame. I think he was in like a war type thing. But I forget all the things he was in. But his character, who's got all this, you know, he's great. He's the CEO of this company, and he's just terrible all the time. He goes and cheats on his wife left and right. He has no problem doing that. Like, he's just that guy. And even when he fails, it's so pathetic and everything like that. But see, to me, Steve McQueen has made 4 movies, which is mind blowing. First of all, that he's only made 4 movies. His first one came out in 2008. He's made 4 movies over 13 years. He's essentially Stanley Kubrick. Well, now,
plus his 5 he made this year.
Well, yeah, what those are all shorts, right?
I mean, shorter, but they kind of make one movie together.
Yeah. Okay. So there you go. I haven't seen that, actually. That's the one thing I was going to say. I haven't seen that. But he takes his time when he makes a movie because he is an auteur. Like, that is, he is an artist. He wants it to be – he wants you to feel everything. Hunger, his first movie about the Irish hunger strike. It's so brutal to watch. Again, Michael Fassbender, actually a scene with Liam Cunningham, Davos Seaworth, that's 23 minutes long, one shot. It's unbelievable. That's what he's trying to – he wants you to feel like you're in it and you can't escape it, just like his characters can't escape it. 12 Years a Slave, that movie, you're following Solomon Northrup all throughout the entire journey that he's on, just like with Michael Fassbender in Shame. Just like with Michael Fassbender in Hunger. And then Widows, he gets a little bit more chaotic. But Widows is a very entertaining movie, in my opinion. And it's just like funny to see Steve McQueen come out and do a movie like that and be like, yeah, I can do this. But yeah. I think he's just got such a great eye. And I do think what helps this movie is that not only did he write and direct it, he also co-wrote it with Abby Morgan, who was a woman. And I think that's what makes this movie not get to the point of a Gaspar Noé, where sometimes it's a little cringy. Because it's never exploiting anybody in this movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, you see at the end of this movie a threesome that is insanely graphic. I mean, there is every body part you could imagine. I still think Michael Fassbender was having sex with people. There is no way he wasn't. And yet it never feels exploited. No. And that is so hard to pull off, especially in an industry that loves to exploit sex, even though they don't like to talk about it and like to give it NC-17 ratings. They love to exploit it. And for him to make this movie and not exploit it and make these characters so human, it's just an incredible feat. It's unbelievable.
Absolutely. And just the fact that you're watching this movie and you kind of have this little bit of disgust for Michael Fassbender's character, but at the same time, you have so much sympathy for him because you can clearly see it's an addiction, even though it doesn't straight up say it. But like, there's the scene where he's clearing out his apartment. And you're like, oh my God, there is so much porn. And it's hinted at earlier when they're talking about his hard drive at work being completely filled with porn. Mm-hmm. And it's like, this is a man who needs help because he is addicted to something. And he just isn't getting that help because it's such a taboo subject.
Yeah. And it's a shame. And like, what's funny in this movie is, or not funny, but what's so good about this movie is that it really is such a full arc for this character too. A lot of times you'll see this and it won't have the full arc, and he is a changed man by the end of it. At least that's how it seems to me, but it all comes from his sister coming in and invading his space. And one of my favorite scenes, you know, that's after he's got to get rid of everything, 'cause now his whole life is just falling apart. And One of my favorite scenes is when Carrie Mulligan goes to get in bed with him. And he goes, get out, get out. And then he screams it at her. Get out of my fucking room. And it's not just get out of my room. You now are getting in bed with me. Mm-hmm. You have now come as close. First it was get into my apartment. You kept calling me. You wouldn't leave me alone. Then it was you're in my apartment. Now you're sleeping with my boss in my bed, but I'm not in there. Now you're sleeping here. And now you're trying to get in my room. That's the moment where it's like, no, I'm pushing back now. Mm-hmm. And now I need to get control somehow over my life. And it's his sister and her coming to live with him and the fact that he can't escape her and she's invading all of these dark, dark secrets. I mean, it's the same way that somebody would act if you went into their house and you found a heroin needle and it was like, wait, you do heroin? It's like, what are you talking about? Like it's the same concept. It's just, it feels so much different because it's a sex addiction. But yeah, I mean, the subtleties of this movie of just going through and how he has to deal with his sister coming to live with him, somebody he clearly doesn't want to be with, who has her own problems that we don't even really get into what her problems are. But just the way she treats herself and treats her brother and is treated by wherever they came from. We're not bad people. We just come from a bad place. One of the best lines ever written. It just works on every level. As we watch this man dive deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper until finally, I mean, to me, the last 25 minutes of this movie, and John, I will let you speak, don't worry. The last 25 minutes of this movie are some of the finest 25 minutes ever put on film in the history of film. I really believe that.
No, absolutely. It's the way Steve McQueen decided to shoot this movie, where almost there are very few scenes in this movie where we're focused on something directly in the center of the screen. Mm-hmm. And it's so impactful when we do get those moments where we are just focused on Michael Fassbender's character in the center of the screen. Because it kind of gives you this emptiness feeling despite everything being around him. And it's all because all these other shots are framed in a way where everything's just off center a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not looking directly onto things. And it's those type of auteur decisions that really helped elevate this film.
One of those is when Sissy and Brandon are having the conversation on the couch when he's finally telling her right before the 25 minutes when he's telling her, get the hell out. You're a leech. I hate you. Like all these things. And she's talking about, but how could, like, you'll never see me again. You don't think that's messed up. The camera's behind them. We're watching the TV between them as you're just seeing the side of their faces. We don't actually see we can't see it. It's unsettling. It's unsettling that we have to look at the back of their heads like we're children watching this argument. How could we possibly be watching this argument? And why can't we get away from it? It's so well done. And it all ends up leading to that get out and I'll never see you again. And he just doesn't care. It just does not matter to him, even in the slightest bit, and he's gone, and it leads to the great shot of the cut to just the bruise on his face, and you're like, uh-oh, something happened. What just happened? But it's those little decisions, though. I mean, it's something that feels so minor, but it unsettles an audience, and it's absolutely brutal.
Absolutely. I also really love Steve McQueen's use of mirrors in this movie, and the fact that, like, the first time we ever see Sissy is in the mirror. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we're just always reflecting on these characters and reflecting on who their true self is. Because that's what a mirror really does. It shows someone who they really are. And that's why we have all this mythology built around mirrors breaking and like vampires not being able to see their reflection and things like that. It's because it shows that real person inside. So when we see characters in mirrors, and we see characters in mirrors a lot in this movie, it's really reflecting on who they are as a person. And even the film itself is kind of this reflection because it starts and ends the exact same way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And did you notice in that first shot what's on Carrie Mulligan's wrist?
No, I didn't.
She's wearing a hospital bracelet.
Oh.
In the first shot that she's in, she's got the hospital bracelet. Mm-hmm. And so what are interesting decisions that you might not think of if you're just watching the movie because you're too busy focused on, you know, certain elements of Michael Fassbender. You're watching this movie, Fassbender and Carrie Mulligan, the first time we see them, they're completely naked. Mm-hmm. And it's this whole idea of like they're just stripped down to their barest like existence, like almost like they're being born into this world of the movie. And Fassbender has nothing. And then he goes in and he's standing in the freaking bathroom while his sister's standing there completely naked. And there's no reaction to it. It's just like, put the towel on and whatever. And she's just drying her hair. I mean, if that's your sister, normally you're like, what the hell is going on? So you know immediately there's something weird about this relationship. There's a reason why Michael Fassbender, Brandon, is the way he is in this movie. Mm-hmm. Because there's no problem with seeing this. There's no problem with doing this. Where most people would have some sort of reaction of like, all right, I'm going to get out of here. He stands there and they start laughing by the end of the scene. So
yeah,
it's just very unique. But go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, yeah, that's exactly what it comes down to. Is it's like it's so normalized for them. Mm-hmm. And it makes you really reflect on how they got to this point. We're never told how they got to this point, but we don't need to be told because we're witnessing it all in these like first few interactions between these two characters.
Mm-hmm. And so let me ask you this then. This is a little bit of a side note, maybe not even something you ever thought about, but this is about the sixth or seventh time I've seen this movie. Cause yeah, I have a weird problem, but sixth or seventh time I've seen this movie. Do you think Carey Mulligan ever actually lived in Los Angeles?
Ooh, that's a good question. Based on the character, like based on Sissy's character, it's definitely a possibility. But wouldn't it make more sense if she was just kind of like stuck in New York the entire time?
And that's almost what I think. Because this was just something I kind of thought of this time, and maybe I'm wrong, and maybe I'm just, you know, looking too far into it. But the fact of the matter is she doesn't really know much about LA. Mm-hmm. She took the bus and oh, you can't take the bus. And it feels like one of those things she says, because that's where she was before this. Oh, I didn't even know Brandon had a sister. Well, yeah, I was in Los Angeles, and oh, but now you're here. Well, I'm going to go back.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, the first shot we see of her, she's wearing the hospital wristband. She wasn't in Los Angeles, at least not immediately before this. So is she planning to go back to Los Angeles, or is she just planning that eventually she's going to end up going somewhere that isn't New York? Because the New York scene, which, you know, to my parents, if they watch this movie, which I don't think they ever have, but if they did, don't tell me about it. But when they sit down and watch this movie, they're going to probably be very bored by that scene of Carey Mulligan, a close up for her singing the entirety of New York, New York. But also the lyrics that if I can make it there, I'll make it anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Sissy is trying to do. The two of them are from New Jersey. We don't really get to know much about their backstory. We just know they come from a bad place. Jordan Alford says, do you think they were molested as kids? I absolutely do. I think that's probably part of the reason why it doesn't matter to them and why she's suicidal and he's addicted. Mm-hmm. But they're from New Jersey and they're both trying to live these alternate lives in New York. She's constantly calling people. No, I don't have to leave. I don't have to do this. Is she calling somebody in LA? Really? I just had that thought this time watching her. I was like, I don't buy that backstory. I just think her entire time, I think she's just been in New York and in and out of hospitals and stuff. And she just tells people LA when she disappears.
It also makes more sense with her being a jazz singer anyways, because that would be something you'd more do in New York than you would in LA.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I hadn't thought about it, but yeah, that makes total sense to me that she just says she's in LA when she's in the hospital.
Yeah, because this, I mean, as we know, when she says to the boss, what's that on your arm? And she goes, I was bored as a kid, and she just pushes it down. I mean, we see at the end of the movie all the scars on her arms. It's not just one. There's multiple scars. And somebody who's trying to be a successful artist or musician or something might say like, yeah, I had a couple things in LA once, like, you know. But did you or did you not? Like, nobody ever follows up on it. So nobody actually ever knows, because nobody ever wants to get to know Sissy enough. And she's clearly crying out. What's interesting in the dynamic of Sissy and Brandon is Sissy is crying out so hard for attention while Brandon is trying so hard to keep people away. Mm-hmm. And it's this constant pushing where it seems like they went through the same things as kids, but it's this constant battle of she needs the attention and she needs somebody there all the time. And Brandon needs people he doesn't know, as we see in the one scene where he cannot perform with Marianne. It's because he cares about her as a person. 2 seconds later, he's having sex with a prostitute and it doesn't matter to him because he doesn't know who she is and he doesn't care who she is. He starts to feel a connection and he immediately cannot react to it. And so it's those little things. And then that is what really does lead him, is these intimate moments with Marianne. And then he goes home to his sister, who's trying to be like, how could you not care about me at all? It all leads to him going on this bender of sorts. You know, people would always say bender when, you know, you go drink for a weekend, or bender when you start doing as much drugs as you can to hopefully die. He goes on a bender of a complete different kind, where he's just going around the city and he's going to essentially, he sexually assaults a woman. And then he goes to a gay club, where we've seen no inclination that he's actually gay in any way, but he goes to this gay club because he needs it so bad and he can't help it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what's that's one of the most beautiful things, because you just see how destroyed he is in that moment, where it's like he is so deprived of sex. He's so addicted to sex that he is in a club and he's totally okay with just like sexually assaulting this woman with her boyfriend right there. And he's like pushing for it. It's almost like the thrill of the pursuit is what's driving him at that point. And then when that doesn't pay off, he goes to this sex club and has an orgy.
Because he can't go back to his safe place because his sister's there. And now she's intruded on. If you think about how it happens too, she intrudes on the laptop first. Then it's the bathroom. So it starts getting more and more personal, and he's running out of places to run to. I mean, as we see him literally running the first time that she takes home the boss, you know, he's running out of places to run to. And so how can he escape? He can't. So now he's stuck doing this. He wants to get the shit kicked out of him. He wants that to happen. And then he wants to just go and do this. And we see him broken, an incredibly beautiful shot where he sits down at the dock there or whatever that is, the pier. And he just is crying as he just sits in the rain. It's like, this man wasn't nominated for an Oscar, and Jean Dujardin won for The Artist. No offense, Jean Dujardin, but come on. People, as I've said numerous times on this podcast, and I will say as we continue through, Academy voters don't watch movies like this. I worked for an 86-year-old. Him and his wife, they would sit down and they would watch Oscar DVDs as they got them. You know, you get the screeners, they'd sit down and watch them. My 86-year-old boss and his wife aren't going to sit down and watch Shame. They're just not going to do it. And that's not a knock on them. 86-year-olds don't want to watch this type of movie, and a lot of Academy voters are that. And so it can come back to that a lot of the time, where, you know, people just this isn't an accessible movie. We talked about A Knight's Tale, one of the most accessible movies of all time. This is not an accessible movie. Steve McQueen doesn't want it to be accessible. He doesn't want you to feel like this is something that you can just turn on in the middle of the day and be like, great, Shame's on. Can't wait to watch it.
Oh, and I mean, it even falls down into like the title of the movie. Who is supposed to feel shame in this movie? Is it supposed to be the characters who are greatly flawed and are dealing with afflictions that they severely need help for? Or is it us who's getting the entertainment from watching it?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Who paid money to sit down and watch this. And that's something with Steve McQueen in general. You know, he wants you to feel like, should I be why am I watching this? And a quick call out to Steve McQueen, because this is the only Steve McQueen movie that's on either one of our lists as we move forward. So we don't have Hunger, we don't have 12 Years a Slave, we don't have Widows, and we don't have whatever this new miniseries is that I will eventually end up watching. But he was the first Black director to have his movie win Best Picture, which was for 12 Years a Slave. Now, obviously, it's a shame that it didn't come till 2014, but to have him represent that and the movies that he makes is just so, I think it's a great thing, because I think a lot of like the movies that he's making, you're not immediately like saying to yourself, you know, we have these stereotypes in our mind of like, oh, who's making that movie? Is that a white guy? Was it a Black? Like, why does it matter? But also that's what you get. And it's why Kathryn Bigelow transcends, you know, when she makes a movie, It's a terrible assumption. People are like, oh, a man must have made that movie. And then it's Kathryn Bigelow. And that's why they like overreact. They're like, oh, my God. Yeah. I think it's the same thing with Steve McQueen, where when he makes Hunger and he makes Shame, it's like, oh, who directed this? And then you look up Steve McQueen, you're like, and I think that that's just the sad reality of what became in Hollywood. And so I think it's amazing that Steve McQueen goes on to be the first director to win this. It paves the way for Barry Jenkins, who then goes on to win for Moonlight. Spike Lee still has not won his Oscar, which Spike Lee for me is hit or miss. But when he makes a great movie, I mean, Black Klansman, come on. So like when he does make a great movie, it's there. And I just think Steve McQueen, the first Black director to have his movie win Best Picture. And I mean, it could have been any of these movies. Maybe not so much Hunger. Hunger is a little bit more of like a you know, it's an experimental thing, but yeah. Shame easily could have won it. And, you know, 12 Years a Slave, as crazy as this is to say, 12 Years a Slave is Steve McQueen until he made Widows. Out of his first three movies, that's his most accessible movie, mm-hmm. which is crazy because it's 12 Years a Slave. Like, that should not be accessible. And yet it is. And it's his most accessible. And I remember when I heard that he was making 12 Years a Slave, we had just watched Hunger. We had just watched Shame. And we were like, oh, boy, like this is going to be. Yeah. And actually, that movie is not nearly as brutal as what Steve McQueen could have done with it, because Steve McQueen mm-hmm. just has one of those eyes, man, where he can just, I mean, he look what he does in this movie. And I mean, 12 Years a Slave obviously is not an easy movie to watch. But when I heard he was directing that, I was like, this is going to be one of those experiences. Still a great movie, but it's not. He didn't go as far, and I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that he had the studio behind him on that one, and they were saying, Oscar time. You cannot be doing scenes like Carrie Mulligan cutting her wrists in the room where it's that much blood. There's a lot of disturbing scenes in 12 Years a Slave, but they aren't in the thing that triggers Hollywood. For some reason, a man standing on his tippy toes hanging from a tree is not as disturbing to Hollywood as a woman with her wrists completely slit open, because there's no blood, so therefore it's not bad.
Yeah, and I mean, this suicide attempt scene, it's brutal. It's not as brutal as it could have been, because we don't actually see the attempt at all. We just kind of see the after effects of the attempt. And Steve McQueen does a beautiful job, as much as you can say that, in setting it up. You know it's coming. The entire movie. And that's rough. But like, as someone who has had a suicide of someone incredibly close to him, like, I wasn't as disturbed by this scene as I could have been because of how Steve McQueen prepares you for it throughout the movie.
Yeah. And I think something to be said, you had said this movie kind of, it begins and ends the same way. Mm-hmm. One of the first things we see Carrie Mulligan do is step next to the train track. And then at the end of the movie, he won't answer calls. And he's going on this trip. And he's doing whatever he's doing. And then he gets we have to get you off the train. And he's like, oh shit, that's probably her. And so he rushes home, and the decision to have us ride the elevator with him, and we don't get a cut. So many directors would cut. So many directors would say, no, gets in the elevator, get off, and like the rush, you know, we got to speed it up. We got to get there. We got to do that. He does not rush it. He makes you sit there and suffer with Brandon the entire time, because Brandon has been a prick this entire movie to his sister. He wanted nothing to do with her, and he did not try to stop it at all. And for us to sit there in this moment where he's coming to that realization, finally, the first time he really breaks down, it's just it's brilliant filmmaking. It really is. And Steve McQueen, if you haven't seen Hunger, if you haven't seen 12 Years a Slave, if you haven't even seen Widows, which is probably the fourth best of his four movies, check them out. Do yourself a favor. They are all worth it, because he does these types of things that a typical director just doesn't see.
Yeah, and it's his ability to linger on things. Even like that opening shot where it's just Michael Fassbender in bed, and he lingers. I personally kind of wish he had lingered a little bit longer. I really like scenes where they linger.
Yeah.
Watch
Hunger, but, okay?
No, it's okay. We have a movie on my list later that's like 8 minutes of eating a pie.
I love it. Oh, I know. A ghost story. I can't wait.
But I love these lingering scenes, and Steve McQueen's so good with them. He lingers on Brandon in the elevator, just like how he lingered on that hanging scene in 12 Years a Slave is like 3 minutes long.
Oh, the sun is setting.
Yeah. And it's so, when a director makes that decision to wait on something, he just plays on our anticipation. He plays on the feeling that we have of, we want resolution. Human beings naturally want resolution to things. And when a director decides to hold off on that resolution, it's most of the time, when done correctly, it is one of the most beautiful things you can do in film.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think there's some, I always love movies with a big tracking shot. I have Atonement on here, which has one of the best, I think one of the best tracking shots ever. I love, you know, Birdman, I know is on a list coming up. The Wrestler, we talked about that tracking shot. You know, do you have tracking shots and then you just have those hold shots where it's a person and it's like, why are we doing this? Even think about the scene where when she's singing, The camera is staying on Michael Fassbender eventually, and he cries, and it keeps staying on him as he's uncomfortably moving around his thing. It's those little things, but it helps you to understand these characters. And ultimately, why this movie doesn't make a lot of money, aside from the fact that it's NC-17, is because this is what people are used to watching. People are used to watching cuts. Oh, he cried. Okay, now cut to something else. Not used to watching a character sing for long times, but it's kind of like the David Lynch film school. I'm just going to stay here until I feel like leaving. And if you want to leave earlier, stop watching my movie.
Yeah, exactly. So, and
yeah, go ahead.
It just transcends art at that point, in my opinion.
So no nominations for this movie. I think the score is beautiful. Doesn't get nominated. The screenplay from Abby Morgan and Steve McQueen is incredible. Direction from Steve McQueen, incredible. Steve McQueen and Abby Morgan both end up, I think Abby Morgan is also a writer on 12 Years a Slave. I know Steve McQueen was. So they end up getting their due, even though McQueen doesn't win Best Director. It goes to Cuarón for Gravity. When it comes to 12 Years a Slave. But when you start going through this, like Fassbender not being nominated, Jean Dujardin wins. It's crazy. This was the year Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy got Gary Oldman his first nomination. People were so excited about that. And I was like, how the hell does this fifth spot not go to him? So it pissed me off so much. I couldn't help it. But you do get the Golden Globe. And if you haven't seen it, go watch George Clooney's Golden Globe speech when he wins the drama best actor, because Fassbender was also nominated. And Clooney is going around asking everybody, you know, complimenting everybody who he was nominated against, you know, this. And he gets to Fassbender and he goes, "Hey man, you ever play golf with your hands behind your back?" And that's all he says. It's so good. It's so good. I was dying. It's one of the best. And, yeah, Fassbender should have been nominated. Carey Mulligan should have been nominated. She wouldn't have won because Octavia Spencer was just a shoe in here. But she should have been nominated. And just no nominations across the board. And I think it's just one of those movies that's it's too out there for Hollywood. And people aren't going to sit down and watch this movie. And I think that's a shame, because if you're not going to watch every movie that is presented to you that you should. You shouldn't be voting for the Oscars. That's just how I feel about that. Stop voting for your friends and vote for what's actually good, and people outside of Hollywood will stop hating you. That's what I feel about that, John. All right. Last thing I'm going to ask you before we're going to wrap this thing up. The movie starts with him on the subway, clean cut. Everything looks good. He's neat as can be. And he's looking at the red hair girl. She's wearing the hat. She's got the jacket on, very closed, everything like that. She gets up, she got the ring, and she's disturbed by him. He chases her. He comes back down. I look at that as like descending back into hell, almost like in The Exorcist when they choose to have Father Karras go back down. But at the end, he sees her. We know what he's been through. She's not wearing the hat. Her hair is huge. You almost don't even realize it's the same girl. She's smiling at him now. She's got something else going on. And we still see the wedding ring, and that's what it more focuses on here. What do we think that this is meant to signify? And I'm not meaning to put you on the spot, but what are you thinking here with this?
So there are two ways you can interpret this, in my opinion. The first is that the film's palindromic and no growth has happened in Brandon at all. Which is a really pessimistic way of looking at it. And personally, how I kind of view it. Okay. And then you have the more hopeful side where it's like, no, he's grown and matured, and like he's not going to stand up here. He's not going to stand up and get behind her at this point. But you kind of feel like that's not what's going to happen, though. You kind of feel like he's still in it, and he hasn't gotten over everything.
And what I think is so smart about this decision is it goes from, at the beginning, like I said, she's tight. She's protecting herself. She's crossing her legs and stops looking at him. And at the end, she's almost daring him. She's almost daring him. Look at me now. I got the wild hair. I'm gonna eye you up. I'm going to get up, and I remember you. She remembers him.
Yep.
And so she gets up, and she puts her hand there, and the focus is on the ring before it goes to his face and then ends. And to me, it's the two temptations of he sees that there is a reason to be into this, because you could get into marriage, and pretty much everybody in this movie who's married or has some sort of marriage doesn't seem like they're very faithful.
No.
And, or you could still go for that wild thing. And I think he's changed, but it's that temptation is always going to be there, and he doesn't really know how he's going to react to it. And I think it's a great ending to not have him get up behind her, because we don't know if he's going to go after her, because now she's almost saying, I remember you. Are you going to get up? And I think it's a great way to end this movie, because we know that she is taken, essentially, and that hasn't mattered to him in the past. Does that matter now? We don't know. And I just think it's a great way to end it.
I love an ambiguous ending.
Yeah,
it just makes you feel like it makes you think about the film, and it's the perfect way to close this film because we don't know.
Yeah,
and I know there are a lot of people out there who hate ambiguous endings and want to overanalyze it to the full extent, but in the end, it doesn't really matter what he decided to do.
Yeah, absolutely, it really doesn't, because at the end of the day, there's an addiction, and you always can relapse. You always can. So that's Shame, everybody. Jordan Alford asked, where do you find Hunger? It's the only one I haven't seen. It is on Prime Video. I think you have to rent it. So it would be like $3.99 or something like that. It's worth the $3.99 rental. You know, I mean, I look at it as like how many times do you really rent a movie? See if you could, if you have a Prime Video subscription, I would go there. Or I think it's like on iTunes or something. Like you can find it. It's around. So definitely check that one out. It's worth it. But this was A Knight's Tale and Shame, our number 97 movies. Two very different things. But don't worry, everybody. Our number 96s are about as similar as we're ever going to be as we go through this list. Two classics from the 1980s, two adventure movies, sort of. One, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. The other, Back to the Future. That is next week's episode. A total change from what we've been doing on this podcast so far. I have Back to the Future. John has Indiana Jones Last Crusade. Two very fun movies. That should be a really just exciting conversation. And for an era, a decade that I don't find to be that good of a decade, it was kind of defined by its action adventure, you know, over the top, feel good sci-fi movies. And I think that this is a good way to kind of set us into motion on the 80s. These are the first movies that we're covering from the decade. So it makes sense that we are. But all of that being said, John, anything that I didn't touch on yet that I should have touched on by now?
Nope.
All right, great. Everybody, like the video. Follow us on Twitter, Survivor Specialist. We tweet about this stuff mostly. Follow us on Letterboxd, really, more than anything. If you get a Letterboxd account, if you're a cinephile, go to Letterboxd. I'm PWood43. He's Jay Millsip. Really, really good thing. You can keep track of all the movies you watch, ratings, all of that. I've been watching movies like crazy. I rate everything now. I hadn't been doing it until this year, and I'm so happy I started getting into it. So follow us over there if you're wondering, like, what are they watching otherwise? Because I know I just said I just recently watched The Haunted Mansion. It's like, how are you doing this movie podcast if you watch The Haunted Mansion? Also, just watched Sherlock Jr. And Only Yesterday. So a Japanese anime movie, a 46-minute silent movie from 1924, and a Disney movie that features Eddie Murphy in, you know, his most iconic role. So it's just fun to have that on there. And, you know, it gives you an incentive to watch movies because you're like, what would I rank that? And where am I going to put it? So that's also where our top 100 lists are. But comment on this video and please give it a like, because that is the most important thing. That's how we're going to keep being able to spread the word about this. And we'll see you next week on Tuesday night with our number 96 movies, Back to the Future and Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. See you next week, everyone.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.